comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you happen to be all over this beautiful planet, thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. I know you could be doing other things, but you chose to be here, and I appreciate that. You know, we are here because you matter and because you have a right to know, and there are just a lot of things out there that the mainstream media won't touch. Lots of things in the world of the strange and the unexplained, and they just don't want to touch it. And so it's important that somebody does, and certainly we're not the only ones, but we do. We do touch those things and talk about them and try to bring you information about them. Tonight, we're going to be diving back into history to talk about some information that and some technology that is very likely having impact on our lives today, even if we're not fully aware of it. And so we're delighted to have with us Tim Ventura. We're going to be talking about the Nazi Bell technology and how far did it go, and has it been further developed, and is it in use today? So we're going to be talking about that, and you know, a whole lot of folks think that almost all the flying things in the air that we can't identify are ours, and they may be. If they are, then it's technology like what we're going to talk about tonight that brought us to that place. We have a free weekly newsletter here at The Kevin Smith Show, and that free weekly newsletter is called The K-Files. It is, as I said, free, but it's, you know, sometimes people think, well, free stuff's no good. Well, let me tell you, we've been publishing that since the year 2000, and we have subscribers right now who subscribed back in 2000. So it must be pretty good. They've stayed with us, and most people who subscribe do stay with us. Some people don't. It's your choice. I mean, you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. But even if you just want to unsubscribe to make a point because you don't like me, you got to subscribe first, right? So what you need to do is get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, click where it says K-Files, subscribe. Now, you're going to get an automatically generated email right then, and it has a link in it. You have to click that link to activate your subscription. That way, we can be sure we're not spamming anybody. All right? So, be sure you do that. If you don't activate your subscription, you won't get it. So, be sure you do that. We also have our members community. The members community is absolutely chock full of additional features and benefits, something I think you would find a lot of fun. We have forums, we have chat room, we also have a chat box that I never talk about. Some people prefer that to the chat room. You get your own photo album to upload your photos, video album, all kinds of stuff, and you get to watch the show live every night. We'll be back right after this, so don't go away. And welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show. You know, last night was our first flight after doing the major computer overhaul that we did. It did not involve all the computers, just one, but the most important one. It went pretty smoothly last night. Now, there were a couple of little hitches that happened last night, but it went pretty smoothly. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I think the problems have been resolved, and so we're looking for a smooth flight again tonight. My guest tonight is Tim Ventura, and he has been my guest before. Tim, welcome back to the show. We're delighted to have you.
Well, thanks for having me, Kevin.
Tim, you had a site, and it was all a buzz. And then it sort of went inactive, and then you rebuilt that site, and it's back up, right?
Yeah, AmericanAntiGravity.com, and I just finished that. That was, a major overhaul of my own. Actually, it was about a two-month project that I worked on this summer. And part of it was, you know, I used to cover all sorts of different subject material, and I'd started out with anti-gravity, but, you know, over time, it just, you get pulled in so many different directions that I wanted to rebuild the site to really reflect the diversity of work that I've just come across, you know, over the last few years. So,
it's all back up and it's rocking and rolling now, right?
Yeah, and actually even more interesting, and I'm amazed that I was able to pull this together. It's all categorized. That's actually kind of scary, but you know, and that was the biggest thing for me is I was really excited to be able to take all of the stories and interviews and photos and all that fun stuff and be able to kind of lump that into categories, and then each one of those categories has subcategories. And so like our topic tonight, if we're talking about the Nazi Bell, I would go to a page called Fringe, and I used that as kind of my catch-all for stuff that wasn't space and wasn't energy-related. The Nazi Bell is a little bit of both, but it's something else. So I have a whole section for Nazi Bell, Nazi UFOs, and other, you know, other Axis legends from World War II.
The Nazi Bell is part legend and part verified, or corroborated, not verified, but partly corroborated and partly legend. The part that is, I'm saying it's partly corroborated, loosely corroborated, I guess we could say, is that the place where it was supposed to have been developed is still there, and part of it is above ground. And it's like looks like Stonehenge, only it's made out of concrete. And the stories are that this is the spot where, I guess you could say, the test launches were done. Now I may have some of that information incorrect, but what is the name of that spot?
I believe that's the Wenceslas Mine, and that's in Poland. It's been kind of it's been disputed because it looks like it's a support for a water tower. People have said that, but then others have said that it looks like I believe they called it the fly trap. So there's definitely some interesting stuff there. Some have suggested that maybe it wasn't an anti-gravity device. Maybe it was basically a processing plant for the nuclear pile project that the Nazis were working on. Others have said that, you know, like Nick Cook has speculated, that that it was definitely some kind of strange effect. Some have said anti-gravity. Others have said torsion fields, which might even lead to time travel. So it gets pretty far out there. It's difficult to tell how much is true and what's true with that.
There are some papers related to this, though, are there not?
Yeah, and one of the interesting things for me, and I mean, if I could just say speak from a personal perspective, I had read, I think it was called Project Saucer, and the first book in it was called Genesis. It was by a fellow named W. A. Harbison, and he laid out this legend. The idea was that the Nazis somehow fled to Antarctica and lived under the ice, you know, and built UFOs. And I read this when I was a kid. It was a science fiction novel, and he put a foreword in it and said, well, this is science fiction, but it's based on fact. It's based on a lot of facts. It's just that the overall conclusion is something that's really difficult to, you know, to support. And so I read that, and I'm sure a lot of other folks have heard stuff like that, too. Mm-hmm. And I dismissed it and said, well, it's interesting. You know, it's a cute story, but that's all it is. And it wasn't until I started really doing research and talking to scientists and inventors with American Anti-Gravity that I started to come back to some of these ideas and realize that to these Nazi secret weapons projects, there's a lot of merit there. There's actually a lot more merit than you might guess at first. And the thing that started to really change my mind was I was fortunate enough, because I was, you know, researching a lot of breakthrough physics stuff, to end up on the doorstep of a lot of defense scientists. And some of them would go on record, others wouldn't. But a lot of the defense scientists, because they're older gentlemen, had heard these stories from the fellows that they came up in the industry with. And there was all sorts of Nazi secret projects, you know, if you believe what they're saying. And this was part of their hand-me-down mythology, was stuff that they had heard about in World War II. John Dering, who was a laser physicist at a company called SARA, S-A-R-A, out in California, he had talked about something called the Rhine Valley Experiment. And this was, for lack of a better word, kind of a traveling wave electromagnetic warfare, maybe designed to disorient bombers. And he thought that it may have actually been one cause of the Foo Fighter reports. He thought that this may have been connected to the Nazi Bell in some way, and that it may have used some of the same theories. So the thing that interests me about it is not necessarily just the Nazi Bell, but this whole idea that in World War II, I think both sides were a lot more advanced than we give them credit for being. And that's kind of hard to accept, I guess, from our lofty position in the 21st century, that they could have built stuff like this in the 1940s.
But well, the basic shape and design of our stealth fighter was Nazi.
Yeah. Well, a lot of things, especially in the electrical engineering realm, were around in that time period. You know, that was really the era of power electronics. And as time moved forward, you know, they started to get more towards signal electronics and now computer electronics. So if you were going to build things that were going to have strange effects or, you know, whatever this thing actually did, that actually would have been a good era to do it, because you had the scientists and the engineers on hand who knew how to work with this, and they were familiar with handling large amounts of power. And the Philadelphia experiment, which I personally believe is connected, that's another example of it, where you have something that, in terms of complexity, is not as complicated as a computer, right, a modern computer, but in terms of power, is using a heck of a lot more. It would have fit very well in that time period.
Well, you know, your statement that they were more advanced than we imagine is certainly true. I mean, we, from time to time, we get a little tidbit of information where something gets declassified, and we think that this is modern, when in fact it's been around for a long time. I remember during the first Gulf War, when they had the, I think it was the Patriot missiles, I think, I'm not sure, but they had these missiles that they were aiming at Scud missiles and knocking them out of the sky. And everybody was oohing and aahing about that. But, you know, the guidance system on the missiles we were using was first developed in the late 1960s by Hughes. And so that was not new technology. It, I'm sure, had been upgraded and updated, but the technology itself was first developed by the Hughes Corporation, or Hughes Aircraft, or Hughes Aerospace, who knows, Hughes something. And but that was in the 1960s that they developed that first guidance system that became that. And look at the Blackbird. You know, that went online in the late 1960s, and they never admitted they had it till the 1980s. We never officially knew we had it until the 1980s when they decommissioned it or retired it.
Well, with the Nazi Bell, I believe, from the research that I've done, the physics actually goes back to Einstein's unified field theory. And I put that in a story. This was the one that I wrote with a great deal of assistance from John Daring, as well as a fellow named Dr. James Corum. And Corum has been called the Tesla behind Tesla, or the man behind Tesla, depending on how you know who you talk to. He actually reversed engineered a lot of the claims about Tesla and showed how Tesla could have built them. And both of these fellows provided me with a lot of information and advice on Einstein's unified field theory. And the part that really captivated me about that was this was something where after general relativity, Einstein felt like he needed to connect gravity and the other forces. And so he spent the rest of his life working on this. And in fact, Michio Kaku had described Einstein's unified field theory as being his inspiration to get into physics, because when Albert Einstein passed away, one of the things they showed on television was a copy of the unfinished theory lying on his desk. So he never did complete it, but what he did do was come up with numerous drafts, and he worked with a number of scientists on it. And he started working on this in the 20s. One of the scientists that he worked with in Germany on this was a fellow named Dr. Walther Gerlach, who had some involvement with oversight, scientific oversight, on the Nazi Bell project. And so, you know, if you were going to say, well, how would the Nazis get Einstein's unified field theory? Well, it would have been through Gerlach, who used to work with Einstein in vetting it and just basically checking the math. So that would have been part of it. And the reason that I believe it's connected to the Philadelphia experiment is Einstein fled to the United States, and his FBI file shows that in 1943, when everyone else with knowledge, you know, of nuclear processes was working on the bomb project, Einstein, who was really kind of the man who brought that to the president's attention, right? He, if I recall, he was the one who pushed Szilard into taking that to Roosevelt. Einstein was actually working at the Philadelphia Navy Yard on a quote-unquote device to explode a torpedo under a ship. And he was working with folks like there was a naval degaussing specialist there, and the fellow's name escapes me, but if I remember correctly, it is the same fellow who's mentioned in the Philadelphia Experiment book, the William Berlitz Berlitz and Moore book that was published in 79. So it's possible that both sides had different drafts of the same theory, and they were both playing with it, and they both saw really, really interesting, unique effects. And looking at it from that context, the Philadelphia experiment is very interesting and very similar to the Nazi Bell.
All right, let's talk about that for just a moment. And when you were with us before, we talked about the Philadelphia experiment, sort of as a side issue. Do you think that the Philadelphia experiment actually took place?
I think that it actually took place. I'm convinced that it took place. What they actually saw is another question. Now, some of the stuff sounds outlandish, like the men who would have been buried halfway in the decks. But then when you look at things like the Hutchison effect, where I've done up-close work with Hutchison, I haven't seen the effect while it's happening, but I've looked at hundreds of his metal samples. I've looked at materials that have been fused together, made sure there are no burn marks or any kind of foul play. I've seen basically what was claimed to have happened in the Philadelphia experiment. So to me, some of the outlandish stuff seems like it's already been kind of verified. I guess the big question would be, they claim that the Eldritch teleported. That was one claim, that it was spotted halfway across the ocean. I have trouble believing that part of it. There's the other claim that it became completely invisible. That, I'm not sure. I'm honestly not sure. I know the physics is there to back up this notion that you could use high-power pulses to defeat radar. In fact, some testing was done by James Corum in for his 1994 paper. He did one, it was called Tesla's Egg of Columbus, if I remember right. And he did testing to show that you could defeat K-band radar with what was proposed for the Philadelphia experiment. So all the physics was in place for it. Even with conventional physics, they probably could have done it.
Is K-band what they were using at the time?
I believe so. I believe that was what they were using, and then they switched to X-band later, and I can't remember when they did that, but as I recall, that's about where it was. Mm. And Corum had also speculated that you could defeat the more modern radars. It would just have to be done a little differently. So.
All right, so how is the Philadelphia experiment? You said it's really very similar to the Nazi Bell experiment. How is it similar?
Well, you're working with high-power rotating magnetic fields. Both experiments were using those. They're using high amounts of energy. They're using magnetic fields. They're using rotation. In the case of the Philadelphia experiment, they were using the ship's degaussing coils. And those are coils that are basically wrapped around the inside of the naval ship's hull. And the idea there was, back in that era, they would have minds that were magnetic in nature. They could sense the magnetic field on the hull of a ship, and just by floating around, literally, the hull would get magnetized over time. It would pick up a little field. That was enough to trigger the mind. So the idea was that they could degauss the hull of the ship. This is very conventional technology. And they used giant magnetic coils to do that. Well, these magnetic coils were driven by, in the case of the Eldridge, they were driven by enormous, enormous electrical generators. I don't remember the exact specs of it, but the Eldridge was one of the first electric drive ships out there, which meant that the engines didn't directly turn the props. They turned electric generators, which then turned an electric motor for the props. Now, when the ship was under drive, I guess that had some advantages, but the true advantage is you're producing so much energy. I mean, this ship had enormous engines, and it didn't have to put that energy into moving. It could have put that energy into anything. They could redirect it to the degaussing coils. They could do all sorts of stuff with it. So being an electric drive ship made it almost the perfect type of vessel to test something like this with.
All right, we have to step away for a break, but we're going to pick up right there when we come back, and then we'll move into more of the technology of the Nazi Bell and what it was and what it was supposed to do, what they wanted it to do, and then did it do it? All right, we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and this is Kevin Smith. My guest this evening is Tim Ventura. We're talking about this pretty mysterious story that's been around for a very, very long time about the Nazi Bell. And at the moment, we're talking about the Philadelphia experiment because Tim said, actually, the two things were pretty similar, the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell. Tim, I wanted to give you the opportunity to wrap up on your thoughts about Philadelphia experiment and its similarities to the Nazi Bell.
Well, the idea that they're similar kind of comes back to this notion of Einstein's unified field theory and how he chose to unify gravity and the other forces. And without boring your audience to tears, essentially he came up with this idea of torsion, or twisting, basically a twisting of time-space, kind of a vortex effect, if you will. And that was how he connected these forces. And so he said that torsion could be used to connect gravity and, you know, electromagnetism and the other forces. And this torsion could have been what was being manipulated by both the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell. as well as potentially the Hutchison effect. It's difficult to tell how far-reaching it is. The thing about torsion, though, and the thing about unified field theory effects is these are non-linear effects. And it's almost like if you turn up the volume control on on a stereo, right? It's logarithmic, and unified field theory effects might be logarithmic. They might go even faster than that. And what I mean is it's not linear. You know, it like if you turn the control up halfway, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's twice as loud. It may be 10 times as loud, kind of like the way they measure earthquakes. And what that means for experiments like the Philadelphia experiment or the Nazi Bell is below a certain power threshold, you won't see anything. And once you cross that power threshold, and you may not even know that you've crossed it, you start to see really, really big stuff happen. So you go from nothing to everything, and you do it all at once. Now, in the case of the Nazi Bell, Nick Cook had talked about, as I recall, this device. It had degenerative effects on organic matter, and it did or may have killed people who came too close to it. It had all sorts of negative effects on materials, some very damaging stuff.
All right, well, let's talk about first, what was the purpose? What were they trying to achieve by building what, and the reason it's, folks, the reason we call it the Nazi Bell is because of the shape of it. It was basically bell-shaped. But what was it they were trying to achieve with that? What was the purpose of this experiment?
Well, I would say, from everything that I've seen, that's not completely clear. And there are really two people who have been at the core of this story. Nick Cook and the original Polish defense journalist who found the story. And that was a fellow named Igor Witkowski. And I've interviewed both of those. I've talked to Igor many a time. And I'm not sure if either one of them really feels firmly convinced they know either. I think the idea was it was really neat, it was really secret, and a bunch of people got killed trying to protect that secret. And that's probably the extent of what's truly known about it. I think the other part that Nick Cook had mentioned was, of all of the different devices that his people were working on, Hans Kammler, who was supposed to be the general in charge of that, chose the bell to take with him. So something about that was big enough to put it beyond everything else.
And when you say he chose that to take with him, what do you mean by that? Take with him where?
Well, as I recall, in the book, they had talked about the Allies closing in, their ground forces closing in on one side, and the Soviet, or the Russians, closing in from the other side. And there was this, basically, they were at this this port, as I recall, where they had to pack things up and hit the road. And from what I'd read, this thing was put onto a Junkers transport plane, and Hans Kammler and this Nazi Bell disappeared. Before he disappeared, he shot all of the scientists. I think he shot about 20 scientists who were on the project and left them behind so that no one would ever know exactly what it did. Now, from talking to Nick Cook, Nick had said after he published The Hunt for Zero Point, I think he was able to trace that one more hop. He found a reference to that plane touching down in Norway, if I remember right. And then his trail went cold after that. So as far as the Nick Cook story, that's really where it ends. You hear about Hans Kammler putting the Nazi Bell onto this transport plane, and it disappears at the end of the war. And I think most people would probably assume, most of the people that I've talked to have guessed, well, maybe it ended up in Argentina, you know? And just the idea being that that's where a lot of the Nazis fled to after the war. They went to South America. And that's possible, but I had also wondered, and this is just speculation, I'd wondered if after the war, maybe the Nazi Bell stayed right there. The best place to hide in World War II was probably right there in Germany. And so I'd wondered if maybe all of this, put it on a plane, cart it halfway around the world, maybe that's just a diversion. And from what I'd read, after the war, a lot of the Nazi intelligence apparatus actually stayed in place. And you probably know this, Kevin, as much as I do, that or, you know, you probably know more about it than I do, actually. But I understand that the Allies recruited this. And, you know, and having a military background, you've probably heard stories about this, right?
Well, I don't have a military background. My background is international police. I've worked alongside our military at a number of our bases and in their areas of operation. But I do know that we had Project Paperclip, where we imported Nazi scientists and sort of baptized their record as Nazis and said, okay, you're good guys now and you work for us. We also, lock, stock, and barrel, took the Nazi intelligence operation in Germany, as Russia, you know, took part of Berlin, and we kind of baptized them and brought them straight into the CIA.
Yeah, and that's what I was referring to, and I can't remember the name of it, but there have actually been some references to it. This idea that, you know, one minute they were Nazis, the next minute they were working for us, and then after a while, when the German Republic got its feet back underneath it, they ended up working for the new German democracy. So a lot of these fellows really never left their jobs; they just kind of changed titles.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, I think it was General, wasn't it, Gehling or something like that, that was in charge of the intelligence operation there in Germany for the Nazis. And he worked out a deal for him and his guys to go to work for what is our CIA now.
Well, one of the things that interested me, and this, again, I'm just kind of talking out loud, but one of the things that's interested me was Hans Kammler. I don't know if anybody had really heard of this guy. He was not a power player, right? He wasn't in the, you know, like we had the deck of cards when we went into Iraq. He wasn't on any equivalent to that during World War II. I don't know if they even knew that the guy existed. If I was him and I had something like the Nazi bell and I knew that fleeing, I mean, you go to any country in the world, you've got a heavy German accent, you know, they're probably going to guess. What I would have done is probably just take off my uniform, just pretend to blend in. You know, I think the guy probably could have disappeared pretty effectively.
And a lot of them did that. Lots of them did that. All right, so let's describe, since we don't know exactly what it is they were looking for in the experiment, let's describe what we know about the experiment and what we know about the bell technologically.
Well, I can't give you the best technological description. Again, I know that they were using mercury. I know that they were using some, they had some agents mixed with the mercury. There have been a lot of claims about, you know, this, that, and the other thing could have done this, but the best explanation I heard was the xerum, if I remember right, basically was, and I believe there were small amounts of thorium in that. That's also used in modern reactor technology as a wetting agent, and it basically helps the thermal conductivity of it. It helps the mercury flow a little bit better. So you know, all of the stuff that's described in this Bell experiment, you're basically talking about rotating mercury, and this would have been a pretty good way to work with rotating magnetic fields. Especially if there was a counter-rotating component to it, which could have created kind of a magnetic shear effect, and probably would have been the way to approach something like torsion physics.
What would you get out of that? Would you get flight? Would you get power? What would you get out of this?
I think the Philadelphia experiment hints at this, and the Hutchison effect may as well. I think that they get a heck of a lot more than anybody realizes. One of the things John Dering had said to me is, he said, the thing about torsion physics, the thing about unified field theory physics is, he said, it's a unified field. And he said, it works both ways. You don't just manipulate gravity, you're also manipulating the other forces. And he said that the thing that people wouldn't realize that would make it really dangerous is, he said, it's like what happens when you pull the cat's tail? You get the whole cat. And what he meant by that was, you get all sorts of really, really strange, potentially dangerous effects. Stuff like these lethal rays that potentially the bell gave off. One of the purposes that Daring thought, he thought that this thing might actually have been developed as some way to, maybe they wanted to fly over the White House with this thing attached to a bomber. He thought maybe they could make it deadly enough to kill everything underneath it. You know, that was just speculation on his part. But the idea was that these unified field theory effects, they disrupt everything. It doesn't just work on gravity unless you know what you're doing. And so he was speculating that potentially this thing could have been a weapon, as well as some kind of a propulsion system, or even, again, potentially some kind of time travel device.
Okay, if it's working on the unified field theory, then if you, I'm just going to use very layman level terms because that's where I am. If you twist gravity, you're twisting time with it.
Exactly.
If you rip gravity, you're ripping time with it. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And you can just imagine, you know, and odds are if you rip time, it heals, right? I mean, I don't think that it would be some kind of a permanent tear in time space like some of the science fiction movies have suggested. But one of the things that like John Daring had said, was what if you have an atom and all of a sudden this field cuts the atom in half, right? No, I mean, you know, so that basically something that once was stable is now intersected by maybe half of this atom is one type of time-space, the other half is in another. The atom collapses, becomes radioactive. All sorts of strange stuff can happen, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is with a field that's going through trillions of atoms and rotating rapidly, you know. It's one of those areas where it could be very well controlled, it could be very well developed if they knew what they were doing, but if they didn't, it could be really dangerous. Now, one of the things that Daring had also talked about was, and this was something that he was convinced of, he believed that the foundation for this kind of work was actually laid by Gabriel Krohn in the 1930s. He thought that Krohn validated this idea that unified field theory effects could be found in these systems.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We're going to come back. We're going to continue talking about this Nazi bell. As strange as it may seem, it is apparently quite possible that the scientists in those days were dealing with forces and things that are affecting us now. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest this evening, Tim Ventura. We are discussing the Nazi bell, and it is both myth, legend, and apparently some facts. The science to do what the myth and legend says was done apparently existed at the time. And so that's what we're talking about. So as we went away for break, we had talked about, you were beginning to talk about how a rip in time would not stay forever, and you were explaining how that would heal itself, and we had to go away for break.
Yeah, I think that's what might happen. Now, it's possible that wouldn't be the case. You know, there was a science fiction movie that speculated that the Philadelphia experiment caused a permanent rip in time-space, and you know, in their view, maybe that was why the Bermuda Triangle happened. But you know, odds are, I would say, that if some kind of strange events happened like this, it would basically heal itself pretty rapidly. But it would still have ramifications. One of those would be radioactivity, potentially new types of radioactivity we're not familiar with. And so this stuff would all kind of tie back in with the really strange effects reported, you know, in Nick Cook's The Hunt for Zero Point.
All right, so we don't know what the Nazi bell was really intended for. We know a little bit about its construction in that apparently it had high-speed rotating mercury going in two different directions, creating field counterfield, I guess. And we don't know exactly what it was they were attempting to do, but let's speculate for a moment, and let's speculate that because of the unified field theory, the parts that Einstein did understand, because of its existence, then is it possible that instead of getting on ships or getting on U-boats and escaping to Antarctica, that a lot of the top Nazis just stepped through a window in time?
Well, potentially, if they had mastered it to that point. I mean, that's a big question, I guess. You know, and I've wondered about that as well. I think probably everyone who's heard the John Titor story has wondered about time travel more seriously over the last decade.
What do you think of the John Titor story?
I'm sorry?
What do you think of the John Titor story?
What interested me the most about it was he's been called libertarian. They've said if it was a hoax, it was definitely a hoax by someone who's a libertarian. But there was some kind of quote where people had said, or someone had asked him in this news group, how come more time travelers don't come back to visit us or something? And there was this moment in this chat session where he said to the person, and again, this was real time while he was discussing things with people, he'd said, I don't want to be the one to break it to you, but people from the future don't really like your time. And to me, that kind of struck me, just because we're dealing with so many issues right now. I mean, environmental issues and population density and pollution and things like that. And something about that, it seemed like there was something real there.
So you think it is possible, then, that John Titor was who and what he claimed to be?
Well, it's an interesting question, although a lot of the predictions that he's made have not come true, although it was too close to tell for quite a while. So one thing I've wondered is, maybe he came from a parallel universe. They say that time travel within a universe or within a dimension can't happen, but if you go from one dimension to another dimension that's almost identical, then it's no problem at all. Well, maybe that's what happened. Maybe he came from a dimension where this did happen. Things were just a little bit different. So.
Well, I don't know. I've actually pondered this thing about time travel a number of times over a long period of time. I've thought about it. And I'm just not really convinced that it's impossible, and yet I've not been convinced of any means by which it would be possible. See, the problem is this. I think if we can conceive of something, and this is not just the old motivational, what the mind of man can conceive, he can achieve. It's not that. But if we can conceive it, then it is a possibility. If you can't conceive ever building a ship that could cross the ocean, then you will never cross the ocean. So if you can conceive that ship, then the possibility of crossing the ocean exists eventually. And I think the same thing is true with time travel. If you can conceive it, eventually it's going to be possible. But what you're saying is sort of the timeline thing, right? If you're on a different timeline, but it's very similar to this one, you could visit this one and move up and down it.
But exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that would be as a result of a lot of energy being applied to some device, or is there some other way to do this?
Well, That's a difficult question. The amount of energy required is difficult to calculate, difficult to guess. I would say that one example would be wormholes. And this was actually a really recent news article. Sonny White, who works at NASA, he's very involved in breakthrough propulsion physics. That's been a pet passion of his. And he was doing calculations on what a warp drive might require to bend time space around it. And some folks had talked about this requiring so much energy, you know, more than the output of the sun to make this thing work. They've said, well, there's absolutely no way we could make a warp drive, you know, unless we find something new. And he said, well, what if we spun the fields? And so he did some calculations, and all of a sudden those energy requirements came down to something, from what I've read, that was pretty reasonable. So I think whenever we set something, it's like you've said, you know, whenever we set something out there and say we want to pursue this goal, you know, we tend to find ways to get towards that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, in how old are you?
Oh, I'm 36 now. So,
well, I'm older than you by a while. I'm old enough to be your dad, and I can remember when people were talking about the idea of ever going to the moon was totally, completely, technologically, scientifically impossible. You couldn't do it. But a few people set their sight on that and developed the ways to do it. Now, there are lots of arguments as to whether they did do it or not, but they certainly built the rockets that could do it. And, you know, just a few years before that, it was impossible. And so the whole thing with time travel, I would think, is a possibility because we can conceive of it. Therefore, it is a possibility. Now, yeah. I have a second part of that, and then I want you to comment on it. The second part of that is everything that's ever going to be possible has always been possible. It's just waiting on right thinking to get us there.
Yeah, that reminds me of, I've had this feeling, you know, and you probably have as well. I mean, as someone who does a lot of interviews with unique thinkers, I'm sure that you've probably felt this too. When I was a kid, I used to think that innovation was something that, you know, that happened, right? It was a spark, you know, and that was it, and then it came into existence. But I think now my view is that spark, maybe it does happen, but often it happens decades or even hundreds of years before the rest of us hear about it. And I think Da Vinci's helicopter, for me, is the most obvious example of that, you know, where we can look back and say, oh, weren't they silly? They had the helicopter right in front of them. Well, what are we overlooking in our own time?
You know, yeah. And, you know, back to the time travel thing. If time travel is possible because of the unified field, anti-gravity is possible.
Yeah, and I tend to believe that that's what the Nazi Bell, to bring it back to that, I tend to believe that that's what they were looking at, was some kind of propulsion device. And my reasoning really is that they were looking for some game changers to win the war. I think that's why they were investing so heavily in all of these really exotic technologies.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll come back, we'll pick up right there, and in a few minutes we'll open up the telephone lines. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted to have you. And my sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from the first hour. And my most sincere hopes, wishes, and prayers that you never suffer that tragedy again. My guest this evening is Tim Ventura. We're talking about the Nazi Bell Project and what information we do have about it. It's a very mysterious thing. Some people say almost a mythological thing. And yet there's some corroboration. There's some papers about it. There's some indications that it actually happened. And we just don't know exactly what it is they were trying to do. But we know some things about its construction. And now we went away for break. We were talking about, I had said that, if we had been talking about time travel, and I said, if you can do that, then you're also generating anti-gravity. And you said that you thought that perhaps that the Bell was a propulsion device being developed or tested. And then we kind of had to go away for break at that point. So let's pick up there. And let me say, for those who are just tuning in, we're talking about this in terms of Einstein's unified field theory, that gravity, space-time, electromagnetic fields, all of that intertwined, unified, twisted together. So think of anti-gravity and or gravity and time, space, as being like two cords that have been twisted around each other, and there's some other fields twisted in there too. So let's talk about how it would affect gravity if you did time travel.
Well, that's an interesting question. When you get into time travel, there are so many unknowns there. One of the things that I've wondered is, if you're traveling through time, is there something to connect you to a specific location? I mean, in the movies, you know, like in Back to the Future, you know, the DeLorean it's on the same street, right? Maybe it's right. A different decade, different, you know, millennium even, but it's in the same place. And I think that's the typical conjecture, is that you'll travel through time, but not through space. But we're traveling through space all the time anyways. You know, the Earth rotates around the sun is moving through the galaxy, the spiral arm is moving. In fact, I've heard that when you add everything up, we may be moving at something like 18,000 miles an hour through space, depending on how you measure it, of course. Mm-hmm. But that just goes to this whole idea of, if you can travel through time but you stay in the same place, that could be really dangerous. Maybe those first experiments are just out there floating around still. Because odds are, if that's what happened, well, you'd travel through time and end up just in the middle of space. So,
well, but see, time and space, we are told, and this may not be true, we are told that is one of the dimensions, is time-space. So if you alter time, you alter space.
Well, that's definitely a possibility. And one of the things that we've seen with quantum mechanics is we've seen stuff like quantum entanglement. And that does suggest that, you know, these entangled particles remain entangled no matter how far apart they get. So maybe entanglement plays a role in time travel. If that's the case, you could travel through time just like they say in the movies without any problems.
Okay, so back to the Bell. The information that we have about it is that, and how accurate this information is, I have no idea, but the information is that you had the upper part rotating one direction, the lower part rotating another, or at least the mercury inside going one direction in the upper part and another direction in the lower part. And we have heard that this caused the thing to lift off the ground, right?
That's my understanding.
And at what point, you mentioned that a lot of people died as a result of these experiments. At what point in this experiment did they die? When the thing powered up and lifted off the ground, or
This is from reading Nick Cook's book, and this is quite a while ago. But my understanding was that, yes, when it was powered up and rotating, regardless of whether or not it lifted up, I think it was the powered up rotating part. That would be basically the onset of these fields and the major field strength. Again, these nonlinear effects when they reach that point of being strong enough to actually, you know, start to see stuff. Right? Then they're already changing a lot of things.
Instead of people dying as a result of radiation, is it possible that they were dying because gravity and time, which holds us all together? I mean, all these molecules and all these atoms that are me are being held in place by gravity and time and electromagnetic fields and all kinds of bondings that rely upon those fields and forces. And if you're standing in the locale in proximity to something that's twisting or untwisting time, space, and gravity and the electromagnetic field, is it possible that it just causes everything that's you to turn loose and you become a puddle on the ground?
Well, that's kind of what I figured, actually. You know, that's actually kind of how I envisioned it, too. Yeah, time and space hold all these things together. They hold the atoms together. And so, you know, God only knows what would happen. But, yeah, it might not be like radioactivity. It might be something very different. Maybe the person turns into a little puddle. It's interesting. And it doesn't necessarily end with the bell. You had mentioned Operation Paperclip a while ago. Now, with Paperclip, I'm not sure if we picked up anybody who worked with stuff like this in Paperclip, but one thing that I found very interesting is the Soviets did all sorts of research with torsion physics. They got into it pretty heavily, and they also had their own version of Paperclip. So maybe they got some of the folks who worked on this project or some of the other projects that were like it.
Most of the people that we got in Paperclip, and there was something like 1,200 scientists that we imported in Project Paperclip. They were Nazis. Most of them, you and I and everybody else out there, we've never heard of them. We don't know what they did, where they went to work. But they were put to work in our defense industries. And you and I have never heard of them. We never will. And we don't know what they were working on. We don't know what they did. So it is possible that we got some of the scientists that worked on the Nazi Bell, and we just never heard of it. The ones we've actually heard of are the ones that went to work at NASA. Those are the ones that we've heard of. Wernher von Braun. Most people who remember the days, the heady days of NASA, when we were going to go to the moon. Wernher von Braun was the face of NASA, and he's the one that talked about going to the moon. And it was under his direction. All the space flights headed toward being able to go to the moon, and he was a major in the SS. He was not a low-ranking person. Just a scientist who had to go along to get along, and he was a major in the SS. And Wernher von Braun had his record baptized, and they said he's okay, he's a good guy, and they put him at NASA. And it was his work and his team and his people that eventually took us into the Apollo program. Those are the ones we heard about. We didn't hear about all the rest of those guys.
Well, I guess I'd file this in the food for thought category. And actually, I have it recorded. Otherwise, I would call it too strange to say is true. But I did an interview with Gordon Novell, who just actually passed away about a week ago. And when I interviewed Gordon, this was a few years ago, one of the questions, obviously, you know, that you ask Gordon Novell is, who killed JFK? And his response surprised me. He said, well, the Nazis, of course, Tim. They didn't just go away after World War II. I thought, well, actually, I kind of thought they did. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That raises even more questions. When we talked about Paperclip, we did. We brought lots and lots of folks into the U.S., lots and lots of folks into our establishment. And like you've said, we're not exactly sure who or what or how deep they got. But if Von Braun is any indication, I mean, it seems like he pretty much had carte blanche.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, I give credit where credit is due. Von Braun certainly did wonders at NASA. He and his people, his team, they did wonders at NASA. And I think it's fantastic. However, that doesn't change the fact that he was a major in the SS, and he was the guy there at Peenemünde running that for the Nazis. And interestingly, there are pictures of him in Antarctica.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I've never heard of that.
I have seen pictures of him in Antarctica during his Nazi days.
Well, this brings up the whole Nazis in Antarctica mythology. You've probably heard of that in the past, right?
Sure.
See, and that's one of the things that I've heard people say is maybe the Nazi Bell ended up in Antarctica. And to me, that's always been really interesting just because of the facts that support it, even though the notion itself is so difficult. It's so hard for me to picture that being real. So,
every once in a while we find out some fact out of World War II that we find extremely difficult to buy because that's not what we've been told all this time, and then we find out the facts, and the history we know does not necessarily bear any relationship to the history as it happened.
Yeah, I think that's probably the understatement of the century.
Mm-hmm. But Joseph Farrell, Dr. Farrell, he's a friend, a mutual friend, both of you and me. And Dr. Farrell has written some books that deal with the fact that the Nazis did not go out of business. The German army went out of business. The German government the German army surrendered. The German government continued, but the Nazi party and Nazi officials never surrendered. None of them were present to sign the surrender at the end of the war. And so Dr. Farrell says that, hey, you know what? They are still in business, and they're still doing things.
Well, I knew a fellow, he actually worked for the government, not in a classified position, but he had a pet interest in the Nazi Bell story. And so he took some vacation time, and he went over to visit the site. And he actually, I don't remember how he got up there, but he climbed up on top of that bell tower and took some photos and saw some bolts that looked like they might have been tie-downs for something. And he came back from that, and to be honest, he wasn't convinced either way. He wasn't any more sure than when he went there. But what he did notice was, this is a pretty out-of-the-way location, this Wenceslas mine. It's kind of near a small village, and it's near a river, and that's about it. It's in the woods. And I guess one of the things he learned while he was there was that it had been purchased by a large conglomerate who had planned on tearing it down to use it as some kind of a lumber store yard or something like that. And that I don't know if they've done that since then or if it's just still lying dormant, but it struck him as kind of odd. And when I talked to him about it, he said, I get the real feeling that whoever was involved with this is still kind of around, keeping an eye on it.
Well, and it's quite possible that some of the secrets are buried underground there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's entirely possible. That mine, is, from what I've read, was flooded. And so I don't think anyone's really sure what exactly was going on down there. And I don't think anyone would really want to risk it to dive down and see, you know, both because of the danger as well as chemicals and all sorts of stuff.
So. Yeah. Yeah. The only way you could really explore it now would be to pump it all out of there. And that might not be possible. It may... There may be a source of water, a spring or something in there that just keeps filling it up. But, you know, it's that would be the only way to explore it. It would be to pump it out.
Yeah. The thing that is interesting, though, is I think the Internet helps this. The more that we learn about history, the more bits and pieces tend to fall into place. And so the Nazi Bell story, we may see another giant piece, you know, come out of left field and may play a role there. One thing that I've wondered is the TR-3B, which is supposed to be the government UFO at Area 51,
yeah.
This was described by Edgar Fouché. He is described rotating Mercury as being involved with that. And he described that over a decade before the Nazi Bell story surfaced. So one thing that I did wonder was, you know, here we have something that, you know, same purpose, same kind of general idea, very similar construction, and they're arrived at from completely different threads of mythology or story, if you will.
Well, and that brings us to what I wanted to discuss next, and that is, let's assume that the Nazi Bell story is real. Now, that doesn't mean we're buying into all of the story and all of the myth, but the thing was there, and they were working with rotating Mercury, rotating in two different directions, which would lead us to think we're talking about magnetic fields and gravitational fields, and we're not talking about nuclear, etc. Okay. Now, let's assume that that is real and that it happened. And I think there's pretty good evidence that it did. What is going on now that's related to that? And you brought up the TR-3B. So what is it that Fouché said about the TR-3B? What does he tell us about that?
Well, again, my understanding of the TR-3B story, when I first heard about this, I had heard about Ed Fouché's, you know, government UFO. That was what it was called. And they said, oh, it's got Mercury in it, and it's rotating, and it's, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And when I first heard that story, I thought, well, okay, maybe it's made up, you know. Who can tell? And it wasn't until I had heard the Nazi Bell story that I went back to it and said, well, wait a minute, how could this guy be describing something so similar? You know, and so I don't know. I kind of wonder. I mean, and that's an area that I'm actually planning on following up with Ed Fouché on, and hopefully I'll be able to put some more pieces of the puzzle together there. But it's entirely likely that the government has some kind of craft. Now, how well that works, what kind of power it takes, I have no idea. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to find out, though.
I'm possibly remembering incorrectly, but, you know, in the ancient Vedic writings, the Mahabharata, there's a description of some craft called Vimanas. Doesn't it describe the use of mercury in those?
Yeah, and as I recall, they were talking about cinnabar, which is a form of mercury. So it is. It's interesting to see how these things. These are some of the magic materials of anti-gravity, if you will. They're materials that kind of come up again and again and again. Mercury, and more specifically, rotating mercury. You know, like the TR-3B, where it's like in a cylinder or something, that comes up over and over again. Another one is bismuth. Bismuth is one of the magic materials where, you know, you can read stories from different sources who have never heard of each other, and they'll all be talking about things. Bismuth comes up, you know, in a number of different sources, and bismuth is also a really interesting material. It's it's highly diamagnetic.
As you apply charge to it, it loses mass.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it has some very interesting properties.
Now, we started out talking about your website, American Anti-Gravity, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's online, it's just www.americanantigravity.com.
Okay. So, now this website has, you've brought together materials about people's work and experiments, and you've got some photographs and all kinds of stuff there about anti-gravity, right?
Yeah, it started as an anti-gravity project, and over time, going to conferences, meeting unique people, just being exposed to different ideas, much like with your show, where you just meet innovative thinkers, and it in a sense almost diversifies itself. And so my focus has tried to be on anti-gravity, and then more recently I've done a lot of energy-related work, too.
Okay. So it started as anti-gravity, and you try to keep your focus on anti-gravity. But isn't, based on what we've talked about here tonight, isn't the development of anti-gravity also the development of the technology to rip up time? And isn't that possibly very, very dangerous?
Well, I think that there are some potential dangers there. But at the same time, for instance, 80% of the public believes that UFOs are real, and they're some form of extraterrestrial intelligence. And they're pretty well documented for having some kind of gravity control. Based on everything I understand, I think that it can be harnessed safely. I think it's probably like anything else. Once you understand the limitations, the dangers, you're able to develop it to do what you need to do and to do it safely.
Okay, so then, flipping the coin over from what I just said, let's talk about this possibility. If gravity is manipulated so that it becomes a propulsion source, or you might say a propulsion system that manipulates gravity, if that can happen, is it possible that it manipulates time inside of the vehicle itself in its locale so that, it really doesn't matter if it takes 20 years Earth time for it to get somewhere? Inside of this capsule, there was only a few minutes passed. Is that a possibility?
Sure, that could be a possibility. Yeah, almost like a form of hypersleep, which, if you go back to the Nazi Bell, that could be relatively interesting, I guess. I'm just imagining what it would be like for a ship to pop open and a bunch of Nazis to jump out into this day and age, you know?
We might find out. I mean, since we don't really know about this Nazi Bell, that has to be a possibility. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back from this break, we will open the telephone lines for you. We'll be back right after this.
Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada. When a topic in history or science or the paranormal is too outré or controversial for conventional media, where can we go for information? To the Kevin Smith Show, of course. I'm a big fan.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and I'm Kevin Smith. My guest this evening, Tim Ventura, and a lot of you have visited AmericanAntigravity.com, and this is the guy right here. This is Tim Ventura, the owner and developer of that website. And we're talking this evening about anti-gravity, but specifically about this mysterious story about the Nazi Bell. The telephone lines are now open, and the telephone number is 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889. If you are in the USA or Canada, please use that number. If you're outside of the USA or Canada, you can use that number, or an additional option for you over on the website at kevinsmithshow.com is the flash message. So you can go over there and scroll down till you see the picture about tonight's show, and right above it a link that says flash message. All right, to the telephone caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
Good.
And Tim, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Oh, Tim. Man, I don't know what happened. Hang on just a minute. Your audio is very garbled. I don't know what happened.
It's a cell phone.
Okay.
How is it now?
All right, hang on just a second. Tim, say something and let's see what we've got.
Okay.
No, we can barely hear you now. It's got a short in it, man.
Okay, give me just a second.
All right.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Now we can hear you. Okay, caller, again, because of the confusion, your first name and from where are you calling?
Tony from Norman.
Hello, Tony from Norman.
How are you two guys doing tonight?
Doing good, doing good.
Doing very well.
Good.
Thank you.
I've seen a few things on TV about the Nazi Bell, and it really fascinates me. And also Edgar Fouché, he's quite interesting. He talks about, first off, that Aurora is not a plane. It's a program, which includes the SR-71, SR-74, SR-75, TR-3BA, B, and C, and that the TR-3s are
the gravity modification, right?
The anti-gravity module is a circular tube with supercooled mercury that spins at an extremely high rate of speed, and the crew or whatever they're carrying has to be within that. And it's a triangular shaped craft, and at each corner there is a rocket engine or a jet engine for directional stability or thrust, whatever, and it reduces the weight of the craft by 89%. And there was also something I wanted to ask you too, Kevin, about I don't know if you got my contact suggestion message about Gordon Duff. He was on Coast to Coast last night,
mm-hmm.
and talking about what you talked about, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago or more,
yeah.
about that stuff that was supposed to be going on in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some awful interesting things to say. I'm telling you, this guy is something. Edgar Fouché and Gordon Duff would be both two guys to have on.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I guess that about does it.
Yeah, let me ask you this. How much confidence do you personally have, having heard Gordon Duff, how much confidence do you have in the things that he said?
I would say 50 to 70%.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little more.
Okay.
He sounded pretty convincing. He sounded like he knew pretty much exactly what he was talking about. And his sources, he was very sure were copacetic.
Well, I will consider it.
All righty.
All right. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, Kevin.
Uh-huh. It's not that I have doubts personally about Gordon Duff. I don't know him. So I have no reason to have doubts. However, the information that he's talking about is information we can sort of see whether it's going on or not, and it sort of doesn't appear to be. That's the problem. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Jerome from Pennsylvania.
Hi, Jerome.
Hi, Mr. Ventura.
Hi.
My question to you is, do you believe that we have a secret space fleet right now?
You know, I've heard so many different variations on that. Now, when you say space fleet, are you talking about like multiple craft, different worlds, the whole nine yards?
Oh yes, I'm talking specifically like including Gary McKinnon, who the United States is trying to extradite over because he broke into their NASA files.
You know, yeah, the idea, because I've heard variations on this, and the idea that we're concealing, I mean, when you think about the number of people that would be involved with it, the crews, the families, everything, it just seems like the logistics of hiding something that large. I just can't imagine how the government could do it. Now, potentially they could, but I don't know. That just seems beyond my imagination.
Well, let me throw this in. They are. Now, whether we're talking about interplanetary craft, that I don't know. But a secret space program, absolutely they've got it. And the way that I know they've got it is because in 2001, I went on the website of the U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command. And on their website in 2001, they had listed their astronauts. These are not NASA astronauts. It's their astronauts in 2001. And it had the list of their names. It had their the commander's name, picture of the commander, and it was U.S. Army astronauts. Now, since that time, we now have the U.S. Air Force Space Command, the U.S. Space Command. We have the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy has astronauts, and they're not NASA astronauts. Now, what are these guys? In order to be an astronaut, you have to have been into space. What are they flying? I don't know. Where do they fly from? I don't know. By the way, in 2001, on the U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command website, they had an application for flyers in the Army, Army flyers, to apply for the Army astronaut program. Hmm. And it listed their requirements, and they could apply for the Army astronaut program. So do we have a space program that you and I don't know about, doing things we don't know about, flying things we don't know about? We absolutely do. But
yeah, that's interesting. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, well, they had it on their website. I put it out on the air, gave the link to it, and it shortly disappeared. But that actually happened in 2001. It was there. You know, you can find little mentions now. For instance, if you go to the U.S. Air Force Space Wing websites, there's several space wings. Go to their websites, and you will find a little mention of astronauts. but you won't find that list. At that time, I think there were 13 astronauts listed. I think that's correct. I can't swear that that number's correct. So do we have a secret space program? We absolutely do. Now, what are they flying? I don't know. What are they doing? I don't know.
Yeah, I know there's a pretty extensive secret apparatus. When you think about all the spy satellites and the way to deploy those and repair them, and you know, when you think about all the infrastructure required for that, the part that stretches my imagination are, you know, if you had hundreds or maybe thousands of people going off-world regularly, it seems difficult to believe that we could keep all that quiet.
Yeah, well, I think we can. That doesn't mean I think that it's happening. But, you can certainly keep it quiet. All you have to do is kill one or two of them that talk.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Kevin, when I mentioned this, I knew you would interject with your story because you've stated that before, and I'm happy you did. But my point is our new space technology is more pertaining to the Nazi Bell than it is anything that von Braun, with his archaic technology of sending up somebody on top of a explosion, controlled explosion.
Well, we just don't know. We don't know. Now, what we do know is that Vandenberg Air Force Base is a more active launch site than Cape Canaveral, and pretty much always has been. So we do know that the military makes more launches than NASA. But we also know that their launch sites are not all in the United States. You know, NASA has launch sites that are not in the United States.
That's true, Kevin.
And so does the military. And so, you know, there's no way to actually know the real dimensions of what's going on in that, what people call the secret space program. We just don't know. But we do know it exists. It absolutely exists.
Well, in closing, let me say real fast, Kevin, I really feel sorry for the casualties of the Nazi Bell, because I'm sure they were slave laborers chained in there.
I think some of them were. I think some of them were probably unsuspecting scientists that just had no idea what was going to happen when, as Tim says, when you pull the cat's tail. You pull the lion's tail, you're going to be eaten. And I think they maybe didn't realize that they were pulling the lion's tail and maybe kind of got puddleized.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ventura, for being a guest on the Kevin Smith Show, and thank you, Kevin.
Certainly. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, and thank you for having me, Kevin. You know, if I could mention, and this is related to the Nazi Bell, although not necessarily directly, in 2000, 2001, around then.
Tim, I hate to do it, man, but a break's taking over. Hold on to that thought. We'll come back to it. Caller, you hang on. We'll get to you right after the break. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Tim Ventura. And Tim, you were about to say something when the break took over and we had to step away. I want you to have the opportunity to finish that thought. And then we have a caller on hold. We are on final approach. We only have a few minutes left, folks. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, I'll keep it really short. But one of the things that John Daring had told me was they did a replication, and it didn't initially come out of the Nazi Bell itself, but of some of the similar technology in around 2000, 2001. And this was, as I recall, this was financed by Joe Firmage and the ISSO organization. And apparently some of the quote-unquote blank spots, things that they didn't know about this technology, were filled in by an older fellow who had worked for the OSS during World War II. So in a sense, even though they weren't trying to do the Nazi Bell, they had a lot of those same ideas that kind of snuck in there. And when they fired it up, and I believe they were using a pretty similar design to what was described later, they had people getting sick. And they were only using about 100 watts worth of power. But from what Daring had said, for the time that they had tested it, people were feeling ill enough that scientists were afraid to go in the room with it, even when it was turned off. So I think that was as close to a replication as he was aware of. But it also kind of validates some of the ideas behind it, that there
sure
might be something there.
Sure. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Rick from Kentucky.
Hello, Rick from Kentucky.
How you been, Kevin?
Doing good.
I have a question for both of you, probably. I haven't heard it discussed tonight. I know there's been TV shows and whatever.
Yeah, go ahead.
That have attempted to connect the Bell and the Kecksburg crash. I just wondered what your opinions were on whether they are or they are not connected. Could the Kecksburg crash have been the Nazi Bell?
Okay, is that question for Tim or for me?
For both of you.
Okay. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, for me, I honestly couldn't tell you. It's an interesting question. I guess the thing about Kecksburg would be it's a pretty well documented case. It's been quite a while since I saw anything about it, so I'm getting a little fuzzy again. But then, what would make Kecksburg, do you think, rather than potentially Roswell or any other event?
It's just been touted as everything about the crash in Kecksburg resembled the Bell, and people that saw it said it had the writing on it and whatever. I just wondered if there could be a connection or if it is not a connection. What your thoughts were on it?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's probably anybody's guess, to be honest. I was just curious to find out what, but it sounds like if there's something there, I mean, potentially, I don't see why not. If this technology didn't, I mean, it disappeared at the end of the war, but then at the same time, it didn't disappear. So potentially it did show up later in Kecksburg. And with any kind of technology like this, it would make sense if there was a crash. I mean, it's new, it's relatively untested. Even if it was a decade later, they wouldn't have many of them to refine to get rid of the bugs in the system.
Okay. Your thoughts, Kevin? Do you think it's...
I would have to say the same thing. I mean, the physical description of Kecksburg object sounds like the physical description of the... Nazi Bell, but beyond being shaped very similarly, it's anybody's guess. But could it be?
Same old problem keeps popping up. We just don't have that proof.
Yeah.
Either way.
Yeah, but whatever Kecksburg was enough of an interest that the military came out, made it disappear, and then you know, this latest court case on it. They said didn't happen, and the court slapped their hands and said, "You're lying." And then they came back and said, "Well, we can't find any documents on it." So, you know, it was enough that it had the military out there collecting stuff. And so, you know, it was not a weather balloon. Rick, I have to run because of the time constraints. Good to hear from you again. Don't let it be so long before your next call. Good to hear from you. We have a flash message we have to get to real quick here from Kevin over in Australia, and he's got three quick questions. Some have been answered. Tim, have you read Dr. Joseph Farrell's works? And the answer to that is yes, and you know Dr. Joseph Farrell. Tim, have you ever heard of strange sightings of the Doctor Who type TARDIS.
No, I've never heard of those. It would be interesting, but I've never heard of those.
Nor have I. But I, if somebody has seen a TARDIS appearing, I want to hear about it. Kevin, what are your thoughts about the Nazi Bell theory? I have no idea what they were trying to achieve. I think that the Nazi Bell stories that we have are grounded in, or are based on real fact, in that it, the experiments actually happened. I think that. I think a lot of the things that get said about the Nazi Bell and those experiments are a lot of conjecture and rumor and myth and in some cases lies. We really don't know what that was for. We really don't know what results they got. But we have pretty good evidence that they really did do it. So that's about as far as I can go with the Nazi Bell thing. I think it's interesting that it's shaped very much like the Vimanas. I think it's interesting that the Vimanas used mercury, cinnabar, used mercury. Then we can sort of conjecture after that. Who knows? All right, very quickly to the telephone for our last call. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. You have to make it real quick. Your first name and from where are you calling?
All right, I'll do it. Kevin, this is Steve from Georgia.
Hi, Steve.
And I'd like to make a real quick quote from the Samarangana Sutra Dhara, which is a 2,000-year-old Hindu text.
You got about 30 seconds.
By means of the power latent in the mercury, which sets the driving whirlwind in motion, a man sitting inside may travel a great distance in the sky in a most marvelous manner. Now, that's 2,000-year-old technology, and it was at use in the Nazi Bell Project, of course. The Nazi Bell Project was part of the Kriegsentscheidung, which was the technology meant to end the war quickly without continuing the war. And I would like to suggest, I know this is going to stir the pot at the very end of the show. That's probably not a good thing, but I'd like to suggest that it worked. And they won. And the way the world is shaping right now is the result of that. And that, along with spinning the wind of the war, they spun the illusion that we won, they lost, but in reality the truth is the opposite. And it took that technology to spin that reality and that illusion together.
I wish we had more time. Steve, you're right. You stirred the pot. There's going to be some people upset with you. But they don't have your address. All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. Very interesting. Tim, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. I wish we had more time. It's fascinating and always is when we get to talk with you. If you will, stay on the line with me for a moment as we bring this in for a landing. And again, thanks. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's pretty much going to do it for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back. Again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.